Okay, good evening, everyone. So we're looking, or we're starting this new series called The Controversial Jesus. And I'm not sure if you guys are very familiar with your Gospels, but he said some rather controversial things, and we're going to look at that over the next few weeks with various interruptions. So, for example, next week we're going to look at the Ascension, and after that, Pentecost, but then we're going to resume with this series, The Controversial Jesus. Now, I want to read a controversial passage from Matthew 15, verse 21 onwards. Matthew 15, from verse 21. Leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. A Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him, crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is demon-possessed and suffering terribly." Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, "Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel." The woman came and knelt before him. "Lord, help me," she said. He replied, "It's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." "Yes, it is, Lord," she said. "Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Then Jesus said to her, "Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted." And her daughter was healed at that moment. So it's a difficult passage because Jesus calls a vulnerable lady a dog, all right? And it's interesting because a couple of people, I mean, through the centuries, but especially recently, have commented on this. And this is their take on it. So this is just a short video. It's about a minute from a pastor called Brandon Robertson. And he is sort of a TikTok pastor. And this is what he says.
There's a part of the Gospel of Mark where Jesus uses a racial slur. In Mark chapter 7, there's the account of the Syrophoenician woman, a woman who is Syrian and Greek, both of which there were strong biases against within the Jewish community. And she comes to ask Jesus to heal her daughter who's possessed by a demon. And what is Jesus's response? He says, "It's not good for me to give the children's food," meaning the children of Israel's food, "to dogs." He calls her a dog. What's amazing about this account is that the woman doesn't back down. She speaks truth to power. She confronts Jesus and says, "Well, you can think that about me, but even dogs deserve the crumbs from the table." Her boldness and bravery to speak truth to power actually changes Jesus' mind. Jesus repents of his racism and extends healing to this woman's daughter. I love this story because it's a reminder that Jesus is human. He had prejudices and bias, and when confronted with it, he was willing to do his work. And this woman was willing to stand up. And there's a part of the Gospel of Mark where Jesus uses a racial slur. In Mark chapter 7...
I'm not sure how clear the audio was. Could you guys hear it? Let me just read to you sort of the main part. He says, her boldness and bravery, referring to the lady, to speak truth to power actually changes Jesus' mind. Jesus repents of his racism and extends healing to this woman's daughter. I love this story because it's a reminder that Jesus is human. He had prejudices and bias, and when confronted with it, he was willing to do his work. And this woman was willing to stand up and speak truth. Now, this guy gets his idea, I think he got this idea at least, from a Baptist pastor called Miguel de la Torre. Now, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but this is sort of the main, I got this on the Baptist Times or something like that online. So this is what Miguel de la Torre says. Her remark shocked Jesus into realizing that faith was not contingent on a person's ethnicity. In fact, Jesus had to admit that this was a woman of great faith. This woman of color, so he calls her a woman of color. I think it's actually quite possible that she was lighter than Jesus, by the way, given that she's a Greek Syrophoenician woman, rather than sort of a Jew. That's more European than Jesus is. This woman of color had to cross the border demarcated by Jesus' culture, but she crosses this border not to worship her oppressor, Jesus, but to demand an equal place at the table of the Lord. She demands to be treated as an equal. Now, I disagree with them. It's interesting to see, however, the cultural lens of our times. Now we shouldn't throw these guys under the bus. That's what happened. People read the Bible and they read the Bible through their cultural lens. As a matter of fact, we cannot do anything else. It's very difficult for us not to read our own worldview into the passage. But sort of to get certain catchphrases from both their quotes, she speaks truth to power. Jesus repents of his racism. Jesus had prejudices and biases. He was willing to do the work. This woman was willing to stand up and speak truth to power. And then she didn't cross the border to worship her oppressor, Jesus, but demanded an equal place at the table. Now, these catchphrases are almost verbatim borrowed from modern-day activism rhetoric, isn't it? I mean, you can recognize all of these things. It's just got a bit of a theological spin to it. Now, I mean, again, I don't want to exhaust this point, but for the man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And they have a hammer, and they are not afraid to use it. So if you train people to view reality through this lens, and they're going to go to the Bible, then that's what they're going to do. They're going to see this nail everywhere. But look, in their defense, it's a difficult passage. Right? I mean, we can ridicule these guys, but it's a difficult passage. Jesus does call a very desperate woman a dog, all right? And I mean, this woman is in distress. She's a parent in distress. And then Jesus first ignores her, and then Jesus calls her a dog. Now, I mean, actually, he calls her a puppy, all right? He uses the diminutive. He calls her a puppy. Now, when I told my wife that, she says, "Oh," I said, "No. It's still not. It's still problematic. In the ancient Middle East, whether you were a newborn dog or an old dog, you're a dog. It's not pretty. I mean, there's something going on there that Jesus calls her a puppy. But don't get too excited about it. It's not like, "Hey, my puppy, how are you doing?" It's calling somebody a dog. It's something difficult that we need to deal with now. This story is layered, and it operates on multiple levels, and I think it's quite exciting. Now, what would have been shocking to Jesus' Jewish audience, and remember, the majority of the first century people were Jews, the first century Christians, rather, were Jews. And what would have been shocking is the fact that this woman is introduced as from an area called Tyre and Sidon. Now, that is geographically dodgy. That's modern-day Lebanon, and for a Jew, you don't want to be in Tyre and Sidon. There are huge chunks in the Old Testament that talks about these places and you know, how God's judgment will be against these guys. So geographically, she's dodgy. And then she's introduced as a Canaanite woman. That means she's ethnically dodgy. They are the stereotypical enemies of Israel, right? So, I mean, the Canaanites, it's like saying Western Province Blue Bulls, South Springboks All Blacks, ANC... DA, you know, it's trying to put these arch enemies against each other. So she's from a geographically dodgy area. She is ethnically dodgy. She's a Canaanite. She's a woman. Sorry, wrong gender. And her daughter is demon possessed. I mean, if she was blind, that's one thing. But she's spiritually dodgy as well. So can you see on all levels, this woman is dodgy. So a Jewish audience would be sitting on the edge of their seat. Oh. I mean, what is Jesus going to do? I mean, if you think of a Bond villain, you know, Scar, weird, I don't know, Eastern European accent, put all of those things together, that's what the Jew would have thought. Oh, this woman enters the front, she's shouting, probably in a high-pitched, witch-like voice. It's bad. All right, that's the setup. But then the super dodgy woman addresses Jesus as Son of David. Ah, now it gets interesting. Because Son of David is a messianic title. Here is a lady from Tyre and from Sidon. She's a Canaanite. She's a lady. Her daughter is demon-possessed. And she recognizes Jesus as a Messiah. Now, I mean, to what extent, we don't know. But it's a messianic title. Now, here's what's interesting. We're not sure his disciples are recognizing Jesus as the Messiah at this point. Peter's confession, you guys know the great confession of Peter, "You are the Son of God," that only happens in two chapters. So she is sort of before Peter. So maybe, you know, we should call St. Peter's in Rome St. Canaanite. You know, she made this confession before Peter, almost. And Jesus keeps quiet. The disciples complain because it's annoying. This lady is screaming, and it almost seems as if Jesus is rude. Why is he not helping her? Why is he keeping quiet? Why is he ignoring her? But here's the thing, friends. Jesus is always looking for a teaching opportunity. He's always looking for a teaching opportunity. So remember when they were on the Sea of Galilee and there's a storm, what does Jesus do? He sleeps. He wants to see their reaction. Because that's what any good teacher does, is he doesn't give you the answer immediately. He lets you experience something. He wants you to react. And then only after that, he sits you down. And then, oh, okay, so let's think about what just happened. That's what a good teacher does. Lazarus is sick. What does Jesus do? It literally says in John 11, and he stayed there for another 2 days. So Lazarus is sick. They say, please come and help Lazarus, and he stayed there for another 2 days. What's going to be the reaction of a Martha and of a Mary, etc.? So his silence is as much part of the lesson as his miracle. Perhaps he was keeping silent to see what his disciples would do. Now, I don't want to say that this is what the text says. I'm holding this very softly, all right? I'm not sure about it, but I think it is. It definitely fits the character of Jesus' ministry, right? That's the reason why he kept quiet, because he was trying to see how they would react. In the same way that when kids came to Jesus, they sent them away. And when Samaritans rejected Jesus, remember what they did? They wanted to bring flames. They wanted to torch all the Samaritans. You just talk about anger issues. And in all those cases, the disciples failed, and it was a teaching opportunity. And I think it is possible, even probable, that Jesus is keeping quiet again because this is a teaching opportunity. All right. And then he speaks in a parable. Now, the fact that he speaks in a parable needs to indicate teaching. Okay, he's about to teach something. So he calls a dog, I told you, he uses the diminutive puppy. And the reaction is not, how dare you? You know, how dare you call me a dog? I'll show you a dog. She doesn't do that. She responds to this parable with a parable. She responds to this parable with a parable. This never happens in the Gospels. I mean, unless you can help me out, but I haven't seen it. The Pharisees always back down when Jesus tells a parable. Like, you know, they mumble about it. And the disciples, they're funny. They go to Jesus afterwards because, I mean, obviously they're on Jesus' team. So when Jesus tells a parable, they're standing behind him. He just said that. You know, they are doing that. And then afterwards, they say, Jesus, why do you speak to the people in parables? And then Jesus tells them why. And then, like, one brave guy, what do they mean? You know, the parables. Just help us out. It's a little bit like when you need information, you've got no idea. Like, I'm not sure if this has happened to you. You know you're supposed to know this guy, and you're taking his number. How do I spell your name again? It's a little, and then when he says, just as you say it, okay, I don't know your name. Please give it to me. So this lady is outshining any male scholar and disciple in the Bible. She responds to Jesus' parable in a parable. And in Mark 7, the parallel account to this, Jesus says, it's better translated as, such an answer. What an answer. He is so excited about how this woman responded. You can even see him smiling through the text. He's so excited about this response, because there's proper banter in this passage, proper banter. This woman is very perceptive. There's great wit. And like I said, she outshines any male that we encounter in the gospel. So this, in my opinion, is at a very basic level how we can interpret this text. There's some surprising insights from what is going on. But there's a second level that is important. And this is to do with Jesus' vocation. Now, Jesus says, I was only sent to the lost sheep of Israel. Very exclusive. It doesn't sound very nice, and to our modern sensibilities, again, that would be problematic. But he's not saying I was sent to the lost sheep among Israel. He's saying I was sent to the lost sheep of Israel. Again, he is quoting something from the Old Testament that had very strong messianic overtones. He's quoting that very famous Isaiah 53 that most of you guys should be familiar with. And I think we should have it here on the screen. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way. So when he says, I was sent to the lost sheep of Israel, he's quoting Isaiah 53. Jesus was doing something very specific. And I think we miss this when we just read the Bible and we say, oh, this is horrible. How can he do that? We need to understand that Jesus was not just a random medical missionary, an itinerant medical missionary walking around, you're healed, you're healed, you're healed. And then, you know, as far as he walks, he's just healing people. That is missing the point. That's sort of reading it from our context. He was Israel's God who is redeeming his people. And we miss this because we don't read the New Testament in its Jewish context. But you guys might be familiar with it, but there's something that we call the Old Testament that comes before the New Testament. And it's there, and it's still there, and it's considered Holy Scripture because we need to understand that. Unfortunately, I know it's a lot to wrestle through, but we need to understand that. We need to understand the Jewish hope and expectation if we want to make sense of Jesus' ministry. And one guy, a much better Jew than all of you, the most zealous of the Jews, a guy called Paul, he reflects on this in Romans 15, and he says, my goodness, Jesus is God's answer to all the promises made to Israel. So he realizes that Jesus is the fulfillment of this Israeli expectation, this Jewish expectation. Remember, I was sent to the lost sheep of Israel, and Jesus is doing that. He's standing in that tradition, and Paul reflects on it, and he realizes, my goodness, Jesus is really the Messiah. He's really that person. And I mean, we're supposed to hear this all over. When Jesus says, I didn't come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. He's trying to say, I'm standing in this Old Testament tradition. Remember the Transfiguration? I referred to it last week for completely different reasons. Transfiguration, Jesus on top of this hill, Moses appears, Elijah appears, Moses goes, Elijah goes, Jesus remains. What are they trying to tell us in this very apocalyptic way? Moses represents the law, Elijah represents the prophets, they go away, it's all fulfilled in Jesus. He represents them. He's the fulfillment of the Jewish hope and the Jewish expectation. Now that's my main problem with the guys that we started out with, is that they're disconnecting Jesus and his claims completely from that context. And you're always going to be confused, and you're going to have a warped view of God and of Jesus specifically when you do that. So yes, Jesus is a Jewish Messiah. He's the fulfillment of that. But there are all sorts of hints all over the place of what will happen when Israel's God comes back. And there were hints of that all over the place. Now, at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, in Luke 4, he is rejected in the town of Nazareth. And he's rejected because of a very specific line that he uttered. In Luke 4, verse 25 to 27, he says the following. I assure you, there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time, when the sky was shut for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath, in the region of Sidon. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha, the prophet, yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman, the Syrian. So Jesus refers to two stories in the Old Testament that's revealed to us you can find it in the books of Kings. And it's stories where pagans receive God's mercy. And his audience doesn't like it. They're blind with their nationalistic sentiment. At this stage, the only thing that they're excited about is the prospect of Israel becoming free and standing up. And when they get excited about Jesus as a possible Messiah, they want him to overthrow the Romans. You guys know the story. And with that expectation, Jesus comes in and he just spoils the party. Instead of throwing his audience red meat, he says, oh, I want to remind you of the two great, you know, when God helped the two pagans in the Old Testament. Not just two random pagans. Naaman was the commander of the Syrian army. He was basically the guy who was in control of killing Israelites. And that's the guy that God heals. And this upsets them so much, they try to throw Jesus off a cliff. Now, here's the thing. Please bear with me. Jesus had two major interactions with Gentiles in his ministry. The Roman centurion in Matthew 8, and this woman. Can you see the echoes that's starting to appear? He heals the servant of the centurion in Matthew 8, and then his response to this centurion, this guy who's in command of pagan armies, or a pagan army, his response to that is, oh, such a faith. I haven't seen such a faith in all of Israel. He just commends this guy's faith. And now, this lady is from the area of Sidon. And by the way, that is exactly the same place where the lady was that Elijah visited. She was also from Sidon. So it's a retelling of these old stories. And Jesus are enacting it in his life. So how can I expand on it? Jesus is acting out the promise that has always been there. In other words, when Israel's God returns, it will be good news for the Gentiles. And there were hints of this all over, as is the case in 1st and 2nd Kings. Now, here's the thing, friends. God is not a nationalistic God. You had that with the Vikings. They had Thor. Okay, that's their God. So if you wanted to worship Thor, you had to become a Viking. Or if you wanted to worship Athena, you had to move to Athens. That's how it worked. But the God of Israel is not interested in just being this sort of small nationalistic God. His mission is truly global. So with this interaction with the woman, he is signaling that this new era is breaking into the now. Are you guys with me? Seems like I've lost some of you, but let's keep going. So in Matthew 8, verse 11, when he talks to that centurion, the other pagan encounter that he had, he talks to him and he says, I say to you, many will come from the east and the west to share the banquet with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. So he uses that sort of as a catalyst to tell us this thing is going to be much bigger than you guys can ever imagine. And now with this woman, he's acting out this parable to say, this is going global. This is going to be far bigger than you guys could ever imagine. And you know what? That's what another thing that I find problematic is that many commentators, not just these guys, many commentators actually say that Jesus didn't realize that his mission was global. He thought that he was only going to redeem the Jews. And this woman sort of expanded his idea of salvation. But if that is the case, then why did this happen 7 chapters ago? You know, when he says this line to the in response to the Roman centurion, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Okay, so the woman calls him Son of David. It's messianic, and he responds by saying, "I came only for the lost sheep of Israel." And this woman's response is remarkable, saying, "Well, even the crumbs that falls off the floor, it's enough for us dogs." Why is she saying that? Because she knows when the Son of David returns, something very exciting is going to happen. And we see this in Isaiah 11, verse 10. In that day, the heir to David's throne will be a banner of salvation to all the world. The nations will rally to him, and the land where he lives will be a glorious place. That's why this lady is not deterred when he says, I only came for the lost sheep of Israel. That's exciting news for me as well. I know what's going to happen when this happens, and I'm part of that. And here's the thing. The inauguration of that is on Easter Day. It's on this side of the resurrection. Then everything changes, right? And it goes to all the nations. But what this woman is saying, Lord, I know there's a big movie coming up. I know it's going to be an amazing movie. I know it's not out yet, but make me a teaser trailer for that future reality. I'm asking for mine now. I know it's going to happen later, but I'm asking for mine now. That's what's happening here. It's an echo of what is to come. This promise was there from the beginning. When God called Abraham, there's no such thing as Israel yet. He says, I'm going to make you a great nation. Why? I will bless you, and you will be a blessing to the nations. It was in there from the very beginning. And that is why, again, a guy like Paul, this zealous Jew, reflects on all of this, and he comes to this conclusion in Romans 15, verse 8. He says, for I tell you that Christ has become a servant of the circumcised, in other words, the Jews, on behalf of God's truth, to confirm the promises made to the patriarchs. So he is the Jewish expectation. He is the promise of Israel. And then he says, so that the Gentiles may glorify God for his mercy. So because Jesus is God's answer to Israel and that expectation, the Gentiles are being drafted on. In other words, you and me are being drafted in. And what Jesus is doing is he's acting out this long story of salvation with this woman, of how God will ultimately redeem the world. Let me put it another way. Jesus calls his disciples. How many? 12. Why 12? He has to gather the 12 tribes of Israel. Again, it's sort of symbolic gathering. And then it's all about Israel. It's all about the 12 tribes. And what happens at the end of Matthew? This is Matthew 15. What happens, I don't know, what's it, 12 chapters later? The Great Commission. He sends the tribes of Israel out to make disciples of nations. Can you see how these things come together? It's for Israel, but it's not just for Israel. Now it's going out. And this lady knew this. This Syrophoenician Canaanite from Tyre and Sidon with the demon-possessed girl. She knew it, and she was excited, and she couldn't wait for that anymore. So she said, just give me a glimpse. I want mine now. So it's an act and out parable. That's the second level of interpretation. I know it was a little bit convoluted, so my apologies for that. The third level, I hope most of you can identify with, is this. This woman is a model for all of us. She is relentless. Jesus calls her a puppy. That maybe sounds too nice. Jesus calls her a dog. And if this happened today, this lady would have started a Twitter account saying hashtag Jesus must fall, and that would have been the end of it. We are all about our rights today, but she doesn't do that. She has a different approach. She says, yeah, sure, I'm a dog, but can I be your dog? No, I think that's what's going on. Sure, I'm a dog, but can I be your dog? And you know who picked up this idea? The Dominicans. The biggest order, I think it's the biggest order in Catholicism. Most of the popes are Dominicans, St. Thomas Aquinas. Dominos, meaning God. Canes, meaning dog. God's dogs. So sure, call me a dog, I don't care, but I want to be your dog. That's what this woman is saying. She's basically saying, I know I suck, but I won't let you go. I'm not coming to you on the basis of my rights. I'm coming to you on the basis of your goodness. You see that approach? She's not standing on her rights saying, well, I demand, you know, humanity and Geneva Conference. She's not saying any of that. She's just saying, whatever, I just want to be yours, and I'll come to you not on the basis of my rights, but on the basis of your goodness. I'm not demanding to be treated fairly. That's what the guys in the beginning said. I'm not demanding to be treated fairly. I'm asking you to give me what I don't deserve because you're a giver. That's what I'm asking. It's a different approach. She's a New Testament version of Jacob. Remember Jacob in the Old Testament? What does he do when he encounters God or the angel, however you interpret it? What does he do? He wrestles with him. It's such a bizarre story, but it's absolutely beautiful. And he says, I won't let you go until you bless me. That's what he tells God. I won't let you go until you bless me. And his name changes. He's no longer Jacob. He's now called Israel. Do you know what Israel means? They who wrestle with God. That's what Israel means. They who wrestle with God. As a matter of fact, he says, you wrestled with God and you prevailed, Jacob. Now you're Israel. This woman wrestled with God in that moment and she prevailed. Now here's the thing. Do we have that same boldness when we approach God? Because here's the tricky balance that we always get wrong. She is more bold than anybody I've ever read about in the New Testament. She's cheeky, but she's more humble than anybody that you read about in the New Testament. She's not, I'm no dog and I demand this. No, yeah, sure, I'm a dog, but I want what's mine because you're good. Give it to me. Not because I know I'm a dog, I know I messed up, whatever. But God, you are good. She's cheeky, but she's humble. She's bold without being self-righteous. Man, that is a spiritual sweet spot if ever there was one. It's almost as if she's approaching God as somebody who understands the cross. Even though she lived on the other side of the cross, it's almost as if she understands the cross and she approaches Jesus under the auspices of the cross. Because the cross means that Jesus died for me because I'm more messed up than I could ever imagine. But Jesus died for me because I'm more loved than I could ever imagine. Jesus, yes, I'm a dog, but I'm also a child. I'm bold and I'm humble. And I think we are standing on this side of the cross. How much more can we approach God with this type of boldness, minus the self-righteousness? Friends, is Jesus racist? No, that's silly. No. He acts out a parable with this woman. I hope you guys got some of the depth of that, how he's acting out this thing that was there in 1 Kings and that he alluded to in Luke 4, and now he's having this game, this parable, and he's acting it out with this unthinkably dodgy woman, and she is wrestling with Jesus. And in the past, the wrestlers were Israel. They are the wrestlers. They wrestle with God. But now this lady is wrestling with God. And it almost signals to this future reality that one day everybody will have access to him. Everybody will be Israel. Everybody will be able to have that kind of intimacy with him, to approach him in that bold manner. Here we are at the south point of Africa. We've got Zulus and Ndebeles and Afrikaners and even some English. And we are thoroughly pagan. We are thoroughly Gentiles. Very little, nothing Jewish about us. But we get to wrestle with God. In boldness, yes, but also in humility. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, we thank you for the lesson that we learn here, that for some reason, Lord, you allow yourself to, in your intimacy, you allow us in to fight. Lord, it's sometimes difficult for us to fathom exactly how you fulfilled these promises, because not only are you the new Elijah and the new Elisha and the new Moses, you're also the new Lamb. In the same way that when you gathered the lamb, the lost sheep of Israel, you had to be slain yourself in the process. You do that and you gather the tribes. And Lord, we are the beneficiaries of the culmination of that great story, where you send people out to the nations and you brought us all in. Help us, Lord, to see that beautiful story, to see that beautiful narrative. And as we reflect on this specific interaction, I pray, Lord, that we will that we will be able to approach you with the same level as of confidence as this lady, and be devoid of our self-righteousness as we do that. Help us to live out the cross. We are more messed up than we could ever imagine, and more loved than we could ever hope for. Thank you for that, Jesus. Amen.